Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 23rd of November. We talk about healthcare reform again this hour. It was a big weekend. Well, sort of a big weekend. Senate Democrats did vote to move into a debate. There was some question about whether or not they would have the votes to begin a discussion of overhauling the nation's healthcare system. We're going to talk about all of that this hour with Edmund Heiselmeyer, who is senior research fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson said that the bill would be a disaster for our country. The Senate bill, it's expensive, would add to the deficit and force some people to lose their health care. Senator Tom Colburn from Oklahoma said the bill does nothing to reduce the rising costs of medical care. And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Americans don't want Congress to enact a health care bill, suggesting supporters of the bill would be punished by voters. We're going to look at the opposition to this bill this hour of the program and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Ed Heiselmeyer is our guest, and we welcome you to the show, Ed. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Would you agree with Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson that this bill would, the Senate bill, that is, would be a disaster for the country?
Well, I think that if it's an exaggeration, it's not much of one. This thing is really pretty dicey and pretty slapped together, and there are a lot of things in here that are going to result in unintended consequences that, you know, we're only just beginning to figure out. And, you know, I would expect if they actually did pass something, they would spend the next year or so trying to fix it.
Really?
Yeah.
What are your biggest concerns?
Well, you're going to have a huge Medicaid expansion. I mean, most of the coverage in the uninsured in this is really a Medicaid expansion, and that imposes significant costs on the states, even though the federal government in this bill would be picking up about 90% of the costs for those individuals initially. It still imposes some significant costs on states at a point in time when states, you know, have their own budget problems. It's questionable as to how good coverage that would be. That's a big problem in there. The insurance regulations that they're proposing are heavily dependent on actually having a mandate that works. In other words, the basic problem you have in health insurance is you want to make sure that you have the right incentives and penalties so that people don't just wait until they're sick to then buy coverage, because at that point, you know, they're going to be receiving more than they're paying in, and the system obviously can't sustain that. Mm-hmm. Now, the way that you prevent that today is by saying, well, you have guaranteed issue to coverage and no pre-existing condition exclusions, but only if you've bought and maintained coverage. In other words, in the employer market, if you come to a new employer, if you've had previous coverage under current federal law, they can't impose pre-ex and they must guarantee, you know, they must give you the coverage. But if you haven't had previous coverage, they can impose at least limited pre-existing condition exclusions. So these bills would get rid of all of that. And instead say, well, there's, you know, you can get coverage anytime you want, there's no pre-existing condition exclusions. Well, at that point, if you're going to make sure that people who are relatively healthy buy coverage, you're going to have to mandate it. And that's what they do. Mm-hmm. But then the question becomes, well, what is the penalty for not buying coverage versus the cost of buying coverage? And so in the Senate bill in particular, you have a real mismatch where the penalty is low relative to the cost. So if you say, you know, well, I'm young, say I'm 25 years old and I'm healthy, and, you know, now they're going to make me buy coverage, or I'm going to pay a $750 fine, and I go out and find out that the coverage is $2,500 or $3,000, well, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Pay the fine. Mm-hmm. Well, then the system starts to unravel. Hmm. And in the Senate bill, that is particularly problematic. Of course, if you increase the fines, then people get upset.
Mm-hmm. When all of this was, the debate was begun, Ed, people were saying on both sides, there are probably, when you look at all of this, of 80% of healthcare reform, everybody can agree on. Would you agree that there are certain things that everybody can agree on?
Oh, I certainly do. And I think the goals we can agree on. And what is dramatically different is not the goals. It's the how do you get there. The goals really are quite straightforward. I mean, I think, you know, you have very, very broad, near universal agreement that the system ought to cover everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you also have very broad agreement that we're spending too much money and we need to somehow control the growth of healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you see much dispute about either of those things. What you do see dispute about, and this is really what comes down to the core of all of this debate, is two things. One, which of those two problems do we tackle first and which do we tackle second? And then the other dispute that you see is what is the mechanism that we're going to use? So essentially what you have here is a bill that covers everybody and then tries to figure out how to control healthcare costs. That's the approach that's been taken in this legislation. What a lot of other folks have been arguing for is to say, well, look, let's first tackle getting better value out of this system. Let's get, you know, the costs under control, and then we'll have the money to cover everybody. So there's that difference in priority of which you tackle first. And you could do some of each. You know, that's the compromise as you go along. That would be, you know, sort of a compromise position.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue is, well, how do you go about doing this? Do you do this by creating incentives to improve the private market and the way it operates, to produce lower cost and more coverage, or do you go about it by having the government step in with a very heavy hand and regulate and micromanage every aspect of this? Unfortunately, the latter approach is what this legislation takes. And I think you saw some of the unintended consequences, if you will, or the political peril, if you will, of that kind of approach in the recent flap that we just had over the recommendations for breast cancer screening. I mean, that is, you know, intimately linked to this bill, because what you have is a U.S. Preventive Health Services task force that makes these recommendations. Now, today, those recommendations are advice. You can take it or leave it. You can decide what to do with it. And by you, I mean the insurers that cover people, the doctors that treat people. They can look at those recommendations, look at the evidence that was behind it that they published that says this is why we came to this conclusion, and then make up their own minds about, you know, what kind of coverage we're going to provide for our employees or what kind of treatment I'm going to recommend for Mrs. Jones, you know, if I'm a doctor. That's all today in the realm of experts getting together, looking at the data, and coming up with some advice and suggestions. And we see this stuff all the time. I mean, virtually every morning on the morning news, you have some health-related thing like
sure.
that. What the bill does, though, what all of these bills do, is they now say, well, every insurance policy in America, public or private, employer or individual, purchased from a commercial insurer or an employer self-insured plan run by a large employer, every single one of them must cover certain services as minimum benefits. And in the case of preventive services, the laws, the bills all specify that they have to cover these certain preventive services with no cost sharing to the patient. And then you look at the bill and they say, well, what do they mean? Well, in the bills, again, every one of them, they say preventive services includes anything with a recommendation of A or B by the U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force. Well, now you're taking what is essentially an advisory body making recommendations, and you're now going to give it the force of law.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people rightly get concerned about, well, what does that mean when, as in this example, up until the other week, the U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force had rated as a grade of B, so in other words, under these bills, it would have to be covered, mammography every 2 years for women over 40.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty straightforward. So now, you know, if this had been passed a couple weeks ago, as of then, every plan would have had to pay for that. Now the Preventive Services Task Force has downgraded the recommendations and says, well, it should only be mammography every couple of years after the age of 50, not the age of 40. And for those between 40 and 50, women between 40 and 50, they say, well, see, it's not probably effective. So then you have the situation of, remember, everybody's got to comply with this, saying, well, all right, now I have to cover certain things, and now, and of course, that adds to the cost. So then I look to the things that they say probably shouldn't be covered. Well, that's where I can save money.
Right.
And so, you know, I think the critics have a very valid point here. I mean, you know, Dr. Healy, Bernadine Healy, who ran, NIH, was essentially on television this weekend saying, ignore it.
Yeah, I saw that. Well, they can always change those, right?
They can, but then you get into the question of, well, all right, what happens when they change them? Now everybody's got to go and redo every insurance plan in America. I mean, this is just one example. I mean, when you look at what the legislation says, it says anything that's rated an A or B by this task force. Well, there's 30 of those already. And the one that I point out to, and this is not by any means an extreme example because there are others, would be the recommendation of intensive dietetic and behavioral counseling for adult patients with hyperlipidemia and associated risk factors. Now, it's one thing to say, well, you must cover mammograms for women, you know, every year or every 2 years. That's pretty straightforward. That's clear cut, whether you like it or not. I mean, you know, somebody who's, you know, putting together an insurance plan or running the HR department at a company can figure that out. But when you have something that's more nebulous, like intensive dietary counseling for adult hyperlipidemia, and remember that if you don't provide this and you don't do it in such a way that the patient doesn't have to pay, then in the case of the insurer, you can't sell the policy. In the case of the employer, you can be fined and whatnot. Well, now people are obviously, who run those plans, going to have questions like, what do you mean by hyperlipidemia? I mean, how high does your cholesterol have to be before we have to pay for it? What does intensive dietary counseling mean? What's intensive? Is that once a week? Is that, you know, that would be 52 visits a year. Is it once every 2 weeks, or is it once a month?
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, which providers are qualified that I have to pay? Is it physicians? Is it dietitians? Is it nurses? What if the cardiologist does it? Do I have to pay the cardiologist because they're not a dietary specialist? Or can I say, well, you know, you're a cardiologist, but you're not a dietitian, so the counseling has to be done by a dietitian? I'm only paying if it's a dietitian. I mean, all of these things, if you're under the force of law that says that you have to do this or else, you have to have answers to that.
Yeah. Let's go back for just a moment. You talked about what we could agree on, and we do have, and most people are a job away from losing whatever insurance they have, and an inordinately high number of people who don't have insurance in this country, who have lost their insurance or can't get their insurance because they have pre-existing conditions and they've gone bankrupt, et cetera. What plans, what realistic plans, and I wish that the Republicans would come up with one that's very detailed so that we have a clear choice of what it is we're going to do to cover everybody, which I think everybody, no matter what your political persuasion, thinks would be a good idea.
Yes, certainly it would. Well, first of all, I think some of the Republicans have. It's just gotten ignored. The Coburn-Burr bill in the Senate. We have a situation where these folks who are running Congress, the majority, and by that I mean really the leadership of the Democratic Party, not necessarily the rank and file, you know, have their way of doing things, and they're not, you know, they're barely negotiating with their own members, and they're just completely freezing the Republicans out. So I think that's very unfortunate, but there are ideas out there. Secondly, and I've been very involved in this work, states have been making efforts along these ways that are paying off. Now, how do you go about doing this? Well, the first thing is to recognize that we keep creating new uninsured people, and the reason we do that is because we tie the insurance to the job, not the person. So if you lose a job, change jobs, you know, that affects your insurance. So what states like, so far, Massachusetts and Utah are piloting right now is a new arrangement for employers whereby they can, instead of having to go out and pick a plan and make all the decisions for the employees, and then, you know, if the employee leaves, they lose their coverage, they can instead say, you know, I'm going to go to the Massachusetts Connector or the Utah Exchange, and I'm going to enroll all my employees in that and your dependents with you, and you get to pick the plan. And the state has arranged it so that all of the coverage meets federal law and state law, so it's guaranteed issue, and et cetera. We've arranged it so that whatever I, the employer, contribute is tax-free money, and if you need to spend more for whatever you've chosen, well, we've got a mechanism here, what's called commonly a cafeteria plan, that you can have that money withheld pre-tax, so that 100% of the premium you pay is tax-free. Now, at that point, the employee gets the choice from the menu of what coverage they want, and eventually over time, as employers move into that kind of an approach, you're not forcing them, but it has a lot of attraction for employers because it makes their employees happy and gets a big hassle off their hands, you're going to have a situation where people go from job to job with the same insurance coverage. And right now you can do that, and as I said, a couple of states are already have the initial pilot programs underway to do that without spending new money or without changing existing federal law. There are some things that you can do to, you know, accelerate that to get them in the other 48 states, but I think if left alone, I'm very optimistic that this would continue to roll out. I mean, I've been working with about 18 different states that are very interested in this kind of approach. And as they see some results from the initial states, I think, you know, you'll see that roll out. So there are ways to do that. One of the things to keep in mind here about the uninsured is it's not a static group of people. You know, if you look at the uninsured over a period of years, there was some very good data that was done. Unfortunately, it's a few years old. But it essentially showed that over a 48-month period, the people who had one or more months being uninsured, fully a third of those people were in and out of coverage repeatedly. In other words, they had insurance, lost it, over just 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another group that's about 29% who, for most of that time, 24 more months, 25 months or more, were covered, but they had one gap in coverage. So if you say, well, you know, if we just get the insurance to stick to the person instead of the job, the problem starts to go away.
When you talk about all these states' efforts and the states you're working with, do you think then, Ed, that this should be a state initiative and each state should come up with their plan, or can we take a national model from what's happening in Massachusetts and Utah?
Yeah, I think that the best approach is to leave most of the details to the states. And this is a big criticism I have of this approach that they're taking in this legislation right now. There's the old management philosophy of say, you know, you don't tell people exactly how you want something done. What you do is tell them what result you want and let them surprise you with their ingenuity in getting to that result. Okay, and so the problem with the approach that they're taking in these bills is it's very prescriptive and very micromanaging. The reality is that these states are dramatically different, and states have a variety of areas in which they are different from each other, and we don't really appreciate how many little differences play out in the health system. I'll give you a couple of examples. Obviously, Massachusetts and Utah, most people recognize as politically sort of on opposite ends of the extreme. I mean, Massachusetts is very liberal. Utah is very conservative as a general rule. But the most significant thing from a health policy point of view, when you look at them, is Massachusetts, when you rank the states with the per capita cost of health care, Massachusetts is the most expensive of the 50 states, and Utah is the cheapest. And in neither case can you see people are getting bad care. I mean, Massachusetts has lots of fine medical institutions, but they also have a culture of just paying whatever just because it says Harvard on it without looking closely at the data, whereas Utah has a very good care, but the dominant provider system there is Intermountain Health, which is like the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, or Geisinger in Pennsylvania, or Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. It's a very value-focused, you know, best results at the best price kind of system. Consequently, they provide care at, you know, per capita, a lower cost than any other state in the country. So those are dramatically different things. And one can go on and on about all the different states with their differences in income, in how their hospital systems are organized, their demographics, the way their insurance rules in some respects work. Some states are very compact. Some states are very rural. I remember a couple years ago working in Kansas, the speaker of the Kansas legislature was a rancher from western Kansas in a county that had no hospital. Hmm. You know, that's not an issue in Massachusetts or Rhode Island.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for Ed. Edmund Heiselmeyer is our guest, senior research fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about health reform and what happened in the Senate on Saturday and what alternatives to the Senate bill may be. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Ed. Let's start with Joel. Hi, Joel. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate that you have a conservative voice on there. And so far, I've agreed with everything your guest has said. I am a physician, and I'm an anesthesiologist, and I'm currently getting 20% from Medicare from what I get from private insurance. And one thing the GAO has not addressed in any of this is how do you fund Medicare? And basically, the Senate bill says you're going to cut Medicare. There's this bill out there that the House has passed but not appropriated, and the Senate won't touch. It's called the Doc Fix Bill, which is supposed to get rid of the 21% planned decrease in Medicare reimbursement for physicians. And that's going to cost somewhere between $200 and $250 billion. Clearly, if that cut goes through, you're going to have very few physicians who are willing to take care of Medicare patients. And, and that's $250 billion. That's not small change in the whole deal. And that's part of fixing the health care system. And I'd appreciate your guest view, and
all
I'll
right.
take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Joel. Ed?
Yes. Well, I think what this physician has raised is another issue that is also foremost with certainly members of Congress, but also some of the public, and that is exactly how is all this going to be paid for. And I think the example of the so-called doc fix is very instructive and in many cases worrying. Let me just, for benefit of your listeners who may not be familiar with you, give you some background to it. Back in 1997, Congress passed some Medicare reforms, as they seem to do every year. And the idea was, well, we're going to keep Medicare on a relatively sound financial footing by only letting physician payments grow by a certain amount in total each year. And then they set some targets. And the way the physician payment formula works in Medicare is the doctors get their procedures paid a set fee, and if the amount that they do, the volume of procedures they do, drives the cost up beyond these targets, what they will then do is reduce the fee. So instead of getting, say, $100 for procedure X, you get $95 or $90, et cetera. That was the theory. And then they made it automatic so that Congress would escape the political pressure. That was also the theory. Well, what happened? The first time that it started to kick in, they got lobbied to not do it. And so they said, well, we won't do it this year, we'll do it next year. And so they passed a one-year fix. Well, of course, over time, the difference between the targets and the reality of the spending grows. It compounds. So now we're to the point where if this went into effect, as your caller pointed out, physician fees would have to be cut by 21%. Well, essentially what they've done in the House, and they tried to do in the Senate, is to throw in the towel on the whole idea and just say, look, we're going to give up on trying to control this cost growth, and we're just going to pay the docs according to the fee schedule. Well, as he points out, that's about $250 billion over the first 10 years. Now, that's offset by about $50 billion of that would come from seniors in increased Part B premiums, so it nets out at about $200, $210 billion. But what's instructive about this is you look at that and you say, well, if Congress designed this and they made it automatic so that they wouldn't take the heat for it and they still couldn't do it and they still couldn't live up to it, what makes us think that any one of these other cuts that are supposedly going to pay for this bill on hospitals or physicians or whoever are actually going to occur? Because, you know, the same thing's going to happen. So you have this weird sort of situation, and it's politically very difficult for those supporting the bill, where on the one hand, if you really make the cut stick, then you're going to anger seniors, physicians, hospitals, et cetera. On the other hand, if you don't make the cut stick, then half or more of these bills is going straight to the federal deficit or to new taxes on top of the ones that are paying for the other half of the bill.
Thanks very much for the call, Joel. You know, it seems as though this issue, Ed, as you well know, is something that we just can't move forward on in this country. It's just difficult. It's huge. It's a huge issue. And so I need to ask you, why is it so big? And can we ever come to a point where we're going to figure out a way, Republicans and Democrats and independents and everybody, how to do this? Why is it so darned hard?
Well, it's hard for a lot of reasons, but let me cut to the chase and say that, yes, I think we can figure out a way to do it, and I've been actually working on doing that, and if you'll indulge me, I'll give you some of my sort of stump speech, because I've been working, as I said, in about 18 different states on a very bipartisan basis with not just Republicans and Democrats, but folks that are quite conservative and quite liberal. Mm-hmm. And the way that I start off is to say, look, we've got to think about this a little differently. Let's start from the point of view that we're concerned, as we said earlier, everybody wants everybody else to have health insurance access, and we all want to control the cost. Or let's put it another way. For all the complaints we have about the American health system, it does a lot of good things, right? But it still has a lot of problems. So it's kind of a glass half full, glass half empty debate. And the point that I would make is, look, I think where we can agree is that we're not getting the value we think we ought to get out of this system. In other words, we spend more money than anybody else in the world per capita, percent of GDP. But we don't seem to be getting the results that we expect out of the system. We're either paying too much for what we're getting now, or we're not getting enough, both as individuals and as society, for what we're paying in terms of, you know, coverage of people, the quality of care, et cetera. So, to me, the key question is, how do you improve that value proposition? How do we get more from the system for the same or ideally less than we're spending now?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that anybody that would say, well, that's, you know, I want to spend more and get less. Okay, we all want to have more for, you know, more and better for less money. Okay, let's start with that. Now, this is where the philosophy comes in. Do you do that by creating the right incentives to reward those people who do a better job of providing value, or do you do it by trying to regulate everybody? And that's the difference. And I very firmly am in the camp that the way that you're going to get that is by creating the right incentives. In other words, if you look at a Mayo or a Geisinger or an Intermountain Health or you know, Cleveland Clinic, the ones that are always mentioned as examples of better value, good quality at a good price. I look at that and I say, what's wrong with the market that we can fix so that they get more of the business, so that people vote with their feet and move in that direction, and the other docs and hospitals have to produce better results at a lower price to keep up and not lose business? So I'm looking at changing the incentives to get you in that direction. Unfortunately, the folks designing these bills in Congress, they look at that and they say, well, if we just go in and study Mayo and Intermountain and whatever, we can come up with thousands of pages of rules to make everybody do the same thing that they're doing. And so it's, you know, do you get this through readjusting the incentives, or do you get this through some sort of command and control exercise in bureaucracy? And that's the philosophical difference. Now, the advantage of what I am proposing, whether you're a liberal or conservative, is we can change these incentives without having to spend a lot of money. That's the good news. So that has an advantage there. And the single biggest change is to have the individuals purchasing their coverage and deciding once a year, hey, do I like the plan I had last year and want to stay with it, or do I want something else? And again, these would be guaranteed issue, no pre-existing conditions. You get to pick from a menu once a year. And now, this is not just theory, it's reality. This is how the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program for federal workers and retirees, and there are 9 million of them, has worked, and their dependents, has worked since 1960. And it continues to deliver better cost control and better patient satisfaction. So the work that I've done with insurance reforms in states like Massachusetts and Utah is to say, how do we create that kind of a model for using the state regulation of insurance for every employer, big or small in the state, to eventually be able to choose if they want to choose that. Now, once people are in that system, you can start to get some creative incentives. Let's talk about preventive care, for example. Right now, if your employer is constantly changing insurance just to keep the premium from going up a percentage point more than the other one, what incentive is there for an insurer to invest in preventive care if they're not going to be around to collect the savings because you're on somebody else's policy? Whereas in a consumer or patient-centered system, if you buy and keep the same policy, and indeed they could, say, offer you rebates if you do, they can create very innovative programs for preventive care, disease management that says, hey, we'll share the savings down the road, but to do this, you have to stick with us for 5 years, say. Now, this is, again, not theory. I mean, this is being done in some places like Switzerland. So you could do that. It's just that right now, nobody has an incentive to do it. The insurers have all this data on the docs and hospitals. But right now, they work for the employer who just wants the costs cut. Well, how do you cut the cost? You just don't pay. That's pretty easy. But if you're picking the plan, do you want a plan? Let's say you've got, you know, four or five that are about the kind you like. They're all about the same benefits, and one's cheaper than the other. Do you want the cheap plan if they say, well, the way we're cheap is when you need medical care, we only let you go to these docs and we make it hard for you to get paid? Mm-hmm. Or do you want one that says, well, no, you can go to any doctor or hospital you want. It's just that we've tiered them. You know, we've dug into the data, and the ones that are graded A are the ones that provide the best results at the best price, and there's a very low copay. B, they seem to be in tier B just as good as tier A, but they charge more, so you're going to have to pay a little more if you want to go there. Tier C, well, they don't seem to be as good, so if you really want it, well, I mean, you have to pay more. I mean, we do this, insurers do this with pharmaceuticals. They can do this with doctors and hospitals. And I've talked with insurers about this, and they say, oh, yeah, we looked into that, but then we put it on the shelf. I said, well, why? They said, well, our customers weren't interested in paying for, you know, the upfront investment to do that. Well, who are their customers? Their customers are the employer. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm just giving you some illustrations of how you need to reorient the system. So where I come from in all of this is I say this whenever I go into states, I say, look, I come here with only one bias, and I put it up front. And that bias is that I believe the system should be redesigned to make everybody else work for the patient in terms of delivering for the patient or the consumer better results at a lower price. That's my only bias. Beyond that, I'm not, you know, trying to protect any interest group in this. And in fact, I'll be very upfront and explain to you exactly how, if you're a hospital or a physician or an insurer or an insurance agent, this will change your business model. You will have to become patient and customer focused in a way that you haven't been before. But I will explain to you why I think that's good for you as well as the patient down the road and how you can adjust to it.
All right, let's go to phone calls. We have a ton of people who would like to speak with you. We go to Jeff from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, hello. I'm not even sure where to begin with this, but let me just make a couple comments and I'll get off. It's just obviously in this debate, there's so much ideology from other, I'm not saying your guest is ideological, but there's so much ideology that comes in on both sides, and there's often this premise on the conservative side that somehow the private sector would do better and the government is going to do worse if we bring them. That's just sort of the ideological bent of a lot of people. But what I have found, I'm self-employed, I have to buy my own, all right? I'm a family of four, all good health, whatnot. And the cheapest plan, people don't know the costs. I find so many people talking about health insurance who don't know the costs of things. The cheapest plan I could find here in Madison for our family of four, you know, we're practically a Madison cliche, we're vegetarian, we jog, we don't smoke, was about $450 a month premium. And then, but that's, we would only get insurance payments after we have a $6,000 deductible. So in other words, it's $1,000 a month out of pocket before we get any insurance company paying for anything. That's without any drug benefits. That's without any eyes. That's it's a crappy plan, and that's the cheapest. My doctor, because I'm over 50, recommended a routine colonoscopy or something. It's amazing to me how many people don't know how much this costs. Your guest talked about the doctor not getting the $100. That's how what we always hear in this debate. The doctor was not going to get the $100 under Medicare, to the $200. A routine colonoscopy, not with symptoms, just to make sure that everything is ticking fine, is $5,500 at Meritor or St. Mary's. I shop around because I have to buy my own out of our health. I have a health savings account, it's called. I would just love for the people in this argument, in this debate, to become better informed about what most people, and there are a lot of people who don't have an employer providing insurance. I'm talking about people who do have insurance, who have to pay for it, what they are paying for. And to say that somehow this private insurance system is somehow working better or could work better than what a government or a single payer or another system might provide, I just think is nonsense. And I'll get off now. Just one last
thing. Okay.
Just the thing that worries me most is that people making these decisions, as you said, in Washington, the people, representatives, the people in the agencies, they have their health insurance, and they probably don't know what these individual costs are. And I will get off and listen.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks very much for the call. There are a lot of people in his situation. That's a lot of money to spend for health care, Ed.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And just to reassure your caller, I have been in exactly his situation in the not too distant past, self-employed with Family Four, buying my own coverage. So I know exactly what he's going through. Certainly medical care is expensive. And that's my point, is that what we need to do is say, well, what are we getting for our money? Does the colonoscopy really need to cost that much? Or are you just getting away with charging that because that's what everybody's been charging and you get paid? The problem in this system is we don't have the data out there and we don't have the incentives aligned so that the doc who says, you know, this is ridiculous, I can do this for half the cost, gets more of the business and the other one has to comply. Now, and this is where I pointed out earlier in our discussion, you come down to a basic, and the caller's right, philosophical disagreement about how are you going to get there. I have no particular love for private insurers. And in fact, I spend a lot of my time explaining to them how what I'm proposing to do is going to change their business every bit as much as what the other side is proposing to do, just in different ways. The philosophical divide is do you believe that with enough rules and regulations the government can make it work better, or do you believe, as I do, that the way to get better value, lower cost, better results is to create a competitive market where the people who, whether they're insurers or doctors or hospitals, who offer the patient or the customer more for less, get the business, and the other ones have to change the way they do business to compete or find something else to do. And that's a philosophical difference. I mean, there's no getting around that. But I don't see how you get the kind of competition that you need and transparency that you need if the government is simply paying for everything. What you get is more of what you saw with this debate over Medicare and how much the docs get paid. It's all about everybody except the patient. And so that's why I'm concerned with some sort of a government approach, is at the end I don't think it's going to be responsive to what patients really need and want.
Couldn't you also say, though, that what we have now is it's about everybody else except the patient?
That's right. That's absolutely right. In fact, I did an entire paper on this, on the sort of basic principles. It's on our Heritage website about a year and a half ago, principles of patient-centered reform. And my point is that we really have in this country a payer-centered system that is half private and half public, meaning that the person who calls the shots in the system is the one paying the bills, but they're not, most of the time, this gentleman being the rare exception, they're not most of the time the one actually receiving the benefits. The payers are either the government or, in the private side, the employer. And so my view is you have to put the dollars and the decision-making in the hands of the patient to make everybody else work for the patient. Now, the other thing that could be done that I think is not at least philosophically controversial, though it might be with the provider groups, is that you can, through government, create the kind of transparency about price and quality. You can pull together and make public the data so that not just the individual looking for the procedure, as this gentleman, your caller, was, but the insurance company trying to figure out who's the best doctor at the best price, who does the best job of hip replacements at the best price, for example, so that they can give that information to their patients when they need a hip replacement. If you create, and that, interestingly enough, that's part of what Utah is doing, create the kind of all-payer database that has all this information that everyone can access to get that information, and start making that transparent, I think that alone will, and this costs very little, by the way, that alone will generate significant improvements in the system.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest, Senior Research Fellow in Health Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Ed Heiselmeyer is with us, and we'll be with you again in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls, and our next caller is Tom from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Listen, a couple of points. I've been an independent business person who's paid their own health insurance for the last 30 years, and I just moved from Illinois to Madison. And in Illinois, I'm a little leery of giving states a whole lot of control because it varies so widely from state to state. And basically, based on my experience, I just don't trust them. Illinois is one of those states that has a lottery, riverboat gambling, a very high income tax, and a very, very high sales tax, and yet we were 48th in school spending in the entire country until just a few years ago. I'm currently paying $304 a month for my own insurance, and then I'm paying an additional $200 a month just to cover a benign nodule in my thyroid. So basically, like your last caller from Madison, I'm paying approximately $6,000 a year for health insurance, and I have a $5,000 deductible. I am employed. I'm a businessman, an entrepreneur, and I really have to go from day to day thinking about, do I really want to get that test? Do I really want to go see that doctor? Or do I really want to pay my rent? So my question is, why can't we just be having government-sponsored health insurance, single-payer, or a public option as a stimulus to business and entrepreneurs? I see millions and billions of dollars given to businesses and bailing out banks and bailing out corporations. And it seems to me the best thing you can do to stimulate business all across the board, whether you're talking about Exxon or whether you're talking about me as an individual, would be to help cover our health costs. I'll take the answer off later. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, I certainly think that that would help business if that they, you know, if the business owner didn't have a lot of those hassles of providing health insurance. And, you know, at some level, there is a logic to doing one of two things, either doing some sort of government-run, you know, public utility kind of single-payer program, or doing what I'm suggesting, which is making it a consumer choice system where the individual worker has the money and decides what's best for him and her or their family. So, you know, there are, I think, you know, you can make the case from a business point of view that either one of those would be preferable to what we have today, where the business is stuck having to deal with all of that and make all the decisions. And I think we're seeing that in terms of the erosion of employer-provided coverage. The other thing that I would mention that the last two callers have pointed out is where a lot of the dysfunction in the current system occurs is in the individual market. And frankly, it's because we put in some pretty reasonable rules for the group market in 1996, but they didn't extend those to the individual market. So that is the kind of federal reform that I would support and have indeed drafted for members of Congress. But to simply copy those rules over into the individual market is really a couple pages of legislation. It's not a 2,000-page bill.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We go to Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I just had I'm a small business owner with about 10 employees and provided health insurance for my employees until recently when spouses who have health insurance through their employer decided that if your spouse can get it from their employer, he can't or she can't be on our plan. So it came to the point where it was going to cost my employees more to use my health insurance because they would have to be dropped from their spouses. So I ended up canceling insurance for my employees. That way it saved them money because they could go on their other spouse's insurance. It's just this whole... The situation is that health care costs a lot, and insurance costs a lot because health care costs a lot. The fee-for-service, what doctors charge, what it costs to provide health care is so astronomically high that the health insurance industry has to charge an extremely high fee. I'm not one of these guys that makes the insurance the boogeyman in this situation. I think we just, and I'm a very conservative individual, I think we need to go to a single-payer system. Tinkering around the edges is not going to work. Making some changes, there's going to be a large percentage of the population that will still, no matter what you do, be able to afford health insurance because it is so expensive.
Ed.
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the advantages of the kinds of state insurance market reforms that I was talking about in places like Utah and Massachusetts, where the problem that this gentleman's encountered would be solved because you would take your employees to, the Wisconsin Insurance Exchange, and they could buy what they wanted, and then they could combine, if they have a spouse that works, whatever contribution they get from their two respective employers and buy what suits the family. And this gentleman, as the employer, would basically be out of the equation, except he would be providing his employees with a way to maximize their money by making it all tax-free. And, you know, that's a valuable service for your employees. And then there'd be a payroll withholding, so whatever they choose, he would simply, you know, adjust the payroll. I mean, this is what they're doing in these states. In Utah, the banks even said, hey, look, you know, we're doing small business banking. Just have the employees fill out the form, tell us what it is, and you know, we'll handle it all for the businessman. You know, people can get what they want, and they can combine their coverage if or their payments if they're a family with more than one worker.
Thanks very much for your call. And that's about all the time we have. Just a quick prediction. What do you think is going to happen? Are we going to see some kind of a bill, do you think, Ed, or will it totally unravel by the first of the year?
Well, I don't know. There are two camps on that, and I've consistently been all year in the, you know, if you ask me, it's sort of 51-49. I'd give it 51% odds that it'll all unravel, but so far I've been wrong, so you can take that for what it's worth.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us. Ed Heiselmeyer, our guest this hour, Senior Research Fellow in Health Policy at the Heritage Foundation. We thank him for being here. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production. We have a growing Facebook community. It's kind of fun to be on Facebook, so if you'd like to become a fan, we can talk more about healthcare or whatever you'd like. You just go to WPR.org and then fiddle around with the mouse and you find Kathleen Dunn and bang, you hit that and then you follow how you become a fan. So that's nice. Tomorrow during this hour, David Plouffe will be with us. He masterminded the Obama victory. His book is The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. So that's coming up tomorrow. Thanks for listening and for your calls and questions, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Great conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.